Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, May 17th, 2021, and I'm the host of the show, Cara Santamaria. And before we dive into today's episode, where we'll be talking about the Blackwell sisters. Absolutely fascinating. I do want to take a moment to thank those of you who continue to make Talk Nerdy possible. Remember, the show is and will always be 100% free to download. And I'm able to do that because of the support from listeners just like you, because of our ad sales partners, and because of, you know, the incredible support of my wonderful assistant, Noelle Dilworth, and the folks at Pro Podcast Solutions who help with all of my editing needs. But really, it's the patrons. It's the patrons that are at the heart of this. If you're interested in pledging your support, you can do it on an episodic basis. You can pledge as little as like a dollar an episode, or a euro, a pound, you know, whatever your currency is. And you can pledge as much as our top patron, $50 an episode, which is absolutely incredible. So this week, I want to thank Mary Neva, Brian Holden, Christopher Pitts, Daniel Lang, David J. E. Smith, Dudas Infinitas, June Sapara, Pasquale Gelati, Ulrika Hagman, Elise Christie, and Robert Christ. Thank you all so, so very much. All right. What is on the docket for today? Well, I had the opportunity to sit down with Janice Nomura to talk about her newest book, The Doctors Blackwell, How Two Pioneering Sisters Brought Medicine to Women and Women to Medicine. Now, Janice is a historian, and so she, you know, approached this from a history of science perspective. She is award-winning, you know, she's one of the New York Times top 50 nonfiction books of 2015, winner and a public scholar award from the National Endowment of Humanities for her previous book, Daughters of the Samurai, and now for The Daughters of Blackwell. You know, the Blackwell sisters, you may or may not have heard of them, and we will dive into this. Many people have heard Elizabeth Blackwell. They've heard of her, but they may not have heard of her younger sister, Emily Blackwell, and they definitely don't know some of the really fascinating details of their lives and why they were such important and somewhat controversial historical figures in the history of medicine. So without any further ado, I'll let her take it away. Here it is, or here she is, Janice Nomura. Well, Janice, thank you so much for joining me today.
It's such a pleasure to be here.
Okay, so like I often say on the show, but every time I say it, I really do mean it. When your book came across my desk, I was like, ooh, yes, please, and reached out to your publicist immediately. So I'm going to once again, I've already said it in the intro, but I'm going to once again read the title, The Doctors Blackwell, How Two Pioneering Sisters Brought Medicine to Women and Women to Medicine. That is one of those titles that it's so rare that you see this where you're like, I know exactly what this book is about.
Oh, a title doing its job.
Yes.
So hard.
But thank you for that. Thank you so much for that.
Well, I had nothing to do with it.
yeah. That is how it usually works, isn't it? Did you have any ideas originally? Like, this is what I wish my book would be called.
No, I had learned in the process of my first book that falling in love with a title in the solitude of your writing room is a bad idea, because titles are big, important things, and people with lots more experience than you should probably be involved in choosing them. So for this one, I was ready to do it by committee.
Yeah, it's pretty funny how much the title really is more of a marketing thing than an actual content thing.
Yeah. Huh. So,
and of course, you've been writing for some time now, but you work as a historian, which involves writing, but also lots of reading.
Yes.
Tell me about that. How does one get into becoming a historian?
Oh, entirely by accident. I mean, the irony of me is that in 11th grade, when our college guidance counselor asked us to write her a letter saying what we wanted to do and be and what we wanted in a college, I wrote her a long, rambling letter. The only positive statement in which was, the one thing I know I don't want to be is a historian.
No.
Yeah. Oh, I have the letter right here.
How did you know that back then?
Because I hated history. I hated history. I liked math and science. I liked English, but mostly because I was a bookworm, not because I liked writing papers. I liked math and science, and I didn't get history. I just didn't get it. I didn't get the whole political, economic, social buckets thing, right? Intro, conclusion, thesis, all that. And I just didn't like it until I got to college. And I stumbled upon a wonderful professor of Chinese history, of all things, who was an extraordinary storyteller. And I learned from him that history is just stories about people. And once you start to live it that way, it becomes extremely exciting. But that's not how the textbooks teach it.
You're so right. I remember being really hung up on history and politics when I was young. Not politics, but history and like econ or history and political science, and being like, I hate these classes. I just have to remember so many names and dates and I get everything mixed up. And like, if I really looked at those courses at the time as our living past come to life, but that you're right. So few people are lucky enough to have it presented that way to them when they're in school.
Right. And I think a lot of that, I mean, I went to college and was never really aware that my college had wonderful manuscripts and archives divisions until I started working on my first book and had to go there to find the papers that I needed that happened to be in the manuscripts and archives division of the college that I had attended for 4 years, a place I had never been while I was a student. And I think that discovery of the rapture of archival treasure hunting is just not something a whole lot of undergraduates get. You have to have a pretty wonderful professor an unusual one to really put in the time to take young people who want to be somewhere else and, you know, teach them how to be treasure hunters that way. But once I found my way there, I was completely hooked.
And so once you did find your way there, history is pretty broad. So like what specifically do you kind of dabble in a lot of different types of history, or were you pretty laser focused in one area?
Well, again, accident. I met a guy in college who happened to be born in Japan. And after college, we married and moved there for several years, came back and, was at that crossroads where you decide to go to grad school because you can't figure out what else to do. But the wonderful advice I got from a wise woman in my life was, okay, you want to be a writer? Don't go to grad school in writing. Don't get an MFA or a journalism degree. Go to grad school in what you think you want to write about. And the most interesting thing that had happened to me at that point was that I had lived in Tokyo and I was doing a lot of writing about Japan. So I went and got a master's in East Asian studies. And fell in love with the period of history that my first book was about, the late 19th century in Japan, when Japan sort of confronted the West and changed very quickly. And then for this project, it was an ecstatic experience to write that book and publish it. And I knew I wanted to do it again. And I knew that border crossing 19th century women were cool because that's what I had just written about. So I needed something else. Another project that connected to something else in me. And the thing that I ended up connecting to was pre-med me from 1989, that hadn't lasted, but I still had this fascination with science and medicine and certainly the wonderfully gory history of medicine in the 19th century. And there was this story again with border crossing 19th century women in it that allowed me to dive back into that whole topic. Which was fun.
Oh, I love that. And so then, of course, that sort of eventually does lead to this story that you tell in your newest book.
Right. So that I ran across the story of the Blackwell sisters, Elizabeth and Emily, first and third, respectively, women in this country to receive medical degrees. And I was astonished that I had never heard of them before. I stumbled across their story 6 years ago, right as I published my first book. And I was looking for a new story. And I couldn't believe that I had never heard of them because I had been born and raised and still live in the city where they practiced. I had gone to a passionately feminist all-girls school from the age of 5, and I had graduated with the intention of pursuing medicine. And how could I have never heard of them? So that told me something about the fact that maybe there were other people who would like to be introduced to them. And so I went diving into the archives to find out more.
And it also just really goes to show how minimized these roles have been, both in our public education system, but also in our public media. I mean, I had heard of Elizabeth Blackwell, which is partially why when your book came across my desk, I was so excited to learn more about her. But I didn't know she had a sister who was also a physician. I'd never heard of Emily Blackwell.
The power of being first, right?
Yes. Yes. And honestly, all I really knew was Elizabeth Blackwell, old school doctor, lady, blaze some trails. Like, that's kind of the extent of my knowledge. So I'm excited today for anybody who A, hasn't heard of her, or B, has heard the name and is like, who's he, what's it again?
Yeah.
To dive deep.
The people who have heard the name tend to say the same thing. They tend to be female and they tend to say, oh yeah, I had a book about her when I was seven. Because there are a lot of Elizabeth Blackwell books on the children's shelf, and there aren't really a lot on the grown-up shelf. And the reason for that is that this is a complicated story. It has lots of contradictions in it and lots of moments that don't conform necessarily to your idea of a feminist icon. Lots of moments where the Blackwell sisters, as extraordinary as they were, are not always admirable. And I think when grown-up biographers sort of turned to them and considered them as subjects, they realized that there was a vexed quality to their story, and it was easier to present it in a children's book with all the complexity kind of sanitized away.
Because to me,
one of the beauties of this story is that it's a story about extraordinary women who were often hard to like. And I know a lot of people like that who fit that definition, and they're some of the most wonderful people I know. And I think, mm-hmm. We would all do better to practice embracing women, especially heroines, who aren't always likable.
Oh yeah. I just shared on my Instagram a few days ago, a quote from Jane Goodall that said, it actually doesn't take much to be considered a difficult woman. That's why there are so many of us.
Right. Right.
It's so good, right?
Yes.
Like, women who don't like do as they're told, keep their head down, stay in their place, are difficult women. And especially back then.
These are two prickly but fabulous women, and you have to take the prickles with the fabulousness.
Absolutely. So let's dive right in. Let's talk about these two prickly but fabulous women. So, okay, what are they best known for? Elizabeth was the very first female doctor in America?
She was the first woman in this country to receive a medical degree in 1849. So it's considerably before the Civil War, a lot earlier than people expect there to have been a female MD.
And did schools, I mean, how did she even pull that off, considering that probably most schools were like, no, women can't attend?
Oh, most schools thought it was just outrageous. There were no words to describe how outrageous the very idea of a woman studying medicine was, partly because being a doctor was outside of the domestic sphere, but also because in order to get a medical degree, you would have to go to medical school and sit in a lecture hall alongside men while listening to lectures on the body. I mean, who, what kind of woman would do that? It was impossible to consider. So when she was trying to get admission to, the more mainstream medical schools in New York and Philadelphia, people either laughed or were so appalled that they refused to even meet with her. It was impossible to consider.
Right.
She was Elizabeth Blackwell, and she persevered. That if there's one refrain in this, it's that Elizabeth Blackwell was not one to back down.
And so what did it take? Did it take like one male ally who sort of fought for her and or sort of just kind of let her in when all of the other doors were closed? I mean, obviously getting a medical degree, sadly, if you're the first woman, is not something you can just do. You have to get permission to do. I mean, you could very well, I guess, sneak into all the classes, but they would still maybe not give you that diploma, which is very necessary.
Right. And dressing in drag was not an option, because this was she wanted. Elizabeth Blackwell came to medicine not because she loved science or loved people healing. She came to it because she wanted to prove something about that ability had nothing to do with sex. And getting a medical degree was a very graphic way of proving that. And to your question of did she have an ally? How did she finally break this barrier? The answer is yes and no. She was in Philadelphia and had found a sympathetic and rather prominent physician who was letting her study alongside him, just sort of watch what he did and observe and read his medical library. And he wrote a letter of recommendation to all of the medical schools that she was trying to get into. One of them was in very remote Geneva, New York, in the Finger Lakes. It was called Geneva Medical College. And His letter arrived there with her application, and the faculty of Little Provincial Geneva Medical College weren't quite bold enough to just reject the recommendation of this prominent Philadelphia physician out of hand. So okay. They punted the question to the students, and they said, okay, students, you vote. If any one of you doesn't want a woman to come study among us, then she won't come. And they thought, okay, we'll be safe. This won't happen.
Right. Somebody will say.
Surely somebody will object to this. And the students, being a rather provincial, boisterous bunch of boys, medicine at this stage in the 1840s was sort of what you did if you weren't smart enough for the law. It wasn't a very taxing profession. It was still considered more of a trade. This bunch of boys said, wow, our professors are cowards. This could be really good fun. Let's say yes. And so they returned a triumphant and raucous yes to the faculty the next day, and then forgot about it. They assumed it was a practical joke that had been cooked up by a rival medical school until 3 weeks later when a young woman walked into the lecture hall.
And of course, that's only the beginning, because then she actually worked with these people. I mean, right. What was that like for her?
Well, interestingly, as soon as she was actually physically present, after, you know, a few days of whispering and snickering, they quickly realized that she was working with a level of brilliance and determination and motivation that none of them could match. And they quickly came to respect her. She rose to the top of the class. And I think many of them realized that if they sat next to her, their notes would be in much better shape at the end of the lecture. She really, by the time she graduated in 1849, she was at the top of the class, and she had really earned everyone's profound respect. Not that they wanted more to come after her, but for this particular woman, this individual person, they had tremendous respect.
And, you know, it's so interesting because we can look at these sort of gender role and gender connection. Well, connection's not quite the right word, but the way that we often will see this recapitulate. And, you know, when there's someone who's, quote, the exception to the rule, or at least that's how it's viewed by the sort of like normative culture. So here we're talking about a heteronormative, like white male culture. And then a woman comes in and they're like, oh, she's the exception. She's very smart. She's very interesting. She's the exception. Let's kind of pat her on the back and say, you know, go you. Wow, you're interesting. Maybe we can learn from you. But unfortunately, there's also the tack, which is taken quite often, where it's like, this is a threat to me. Let's figure out how to undermine this. Let's figure out how to put her in her place or prevent her from being able to shine. So in a way, it's good that Elizabeth, at least, was able to kind of prove her worth, and that the men in her, you know, her colleagues were able to say, look at you, you're worthwhile. But I can only imagine that there must have been some of that othering. You see it a lot with, you know, race relations in this country as well. You see people, I'm not racist, I have a black friend. And then when you really dig deep, it's like, but you see that person as an exception to a rule. You don't see them as normative.
Right. I mean, I think that the image that I came to when writing about her graduation from Geneva Medical College was that she was like a comet. She was this glorious streak of light across the sky that everybody looked at and went, ooh, but the stars stayed in their places and nothing else about the cosmos changed. and comets are few and far between, right? We don't have comets every night. Comets are nice, but they only come around once every, you know, several decades. That idea that she was astonishing, but now let's get back to the way things usually are.
Right. And so then, of course, I mean, I still want to continue on to Elizabeth's career and all of the incredible things that she did and some of the hurdles that she was up against. But of course, so now we think of this, you know, historically, when we look in hindsight and go, okay, she blazed the trail and everybody was standing on her shoulders, and then the door was open. But that's not really how it worked out,
no.
Is it?
Right. Yeah. No, that's how she thought it would go. She figured if she could prove that this was possible, that that other women would follow her, and other male medical institutions would let them in. And the truth is, other women did follow her, but the male medical institutions closed their doors even harder. Having realized that a woman could do this, they were even more determined to prevent it. And to complicate matters, at the same time, just after Elizabeth graduated, the first female medical colleges began to open, one in Boston and one in Philadelphia around 1850. And once those institutions opened, the mainstream male medical institutions had no reason to have to admit a woman. They could say, go there, go to the women's right. colleges. They're for you. Why do you have to come here? So in fact, when Emily came along 5 years later, Elizabeth sort of anointed her younger sister to follow her into medicine because she wanted some company. It was even harder for Emily to find a place. Even Geneva College said, no, thanks. We've had one Blackwell sister. We don't need another one.
You know, I'm interested kind of looking back at the time when these all-women medical colleges opened up. Were you able to find any information about the quality of the education? Would you say that they were kind of, you know, separate but equal, or were they actually getting a subpar education at these universities? Or did we have the opposite, where these women were working, you know, so hard to overcome, and the male institutions had become a little bit complacent?
No, I think this was separate but mediocre. As far as the Blackwell sisters were concerned, they looked at the graduates coming out of the female medical colleges and really were not impressed. Sort of by definition, the men who were the professors in these medical colleges, because they weren't largely led by women, were by definition not at the top of their game. Because if they were at the top of their game, why would they need to be teaching at a women's medical college?
I see.
Right. So the Blackwell sisters, once they had finished all their training, converged and founded the New York Infirmary for Indigent Women and Children, which was partly to provide free medical care to women in the tenements who wanted to consult a female doctor, but also to be a place for the women graduates coming out of the female medical colleges to come and train. And when they started to receive those graduates and use them as their resident assistants, they were not impressed with the quality of the education. And ironically, what they ended up doing was something they had never wanted to do, which was found a women's medical college of their own. Attached to their infirmary and make it better than, not just better than the other women's medical colleges, but better than the men's colleges too.
Right. Okay. So we've got these women's colleges that are opened up. Where did Emily end up attending? Did she go to a women's college?
No, there was some healthy rivalry there, or competitive spirit. I don't mm-hmm. think Emily had any intention of winning a degree that was any less prestigious than the one her sister had won. Not that Geneva College was particularly prestigious, but at least it was a men's medical college. So Emily first started at Rush College, which was in Chicago, had a wonderful first year there, at which point her mentor went on sabbatical. And the trustees, after she arrived for her second year, because medical school was only 2 years then, mm-hmm. she arrived and they said, actually, could you go away? We don't want you here anymore. And instead of, you know, going home to lick her wounds, she pivoted and went to Cleveland Medical College and finished up there. Cleveland Medical College has evolved into Case Western.
Okay.
So officially, she got her degree from there.
Yeah. Okay. And so at the time, once she graduated, Elizabeth had now been practicing for a few years.
Right. So both women, once they graduated, they needed some practical experience because medical school then consisted of 2 consecutive years of lectures. That's all. You could graduate from medical school without ever touching a living patient. So you needed to go and...
Uh-oh.
Yeah, an alarming degree of ignorance. So what both women did was what many young men graduating from medical school in America did, which was to go to Europe, to the capitals of medical education, London, Paris, Edinburgh, and get their practical experience there. Both women ended up getting experience in Europe before they came back to New York to found their hospital.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So they go, they get this experience, and then they decide we need a place here in the U.S. where women can train, but also where we can offer services to low-income women, to women who are out on the streets, so that they can get, I'm assuming, like, not just the medical care, but I guess it is also medical care, but the like OBGYN care that they need.
Right. It becomes both a hospital and a public health center in a way. And it becomes necessary to found a hospital because when they get back to New York to, you know, open a practice, they quickly discover that they're ahead of their time. And even, even progressive minded women who have enough money to choose their medical care don't want to consult a woman doctor. The very phrase female physician in the early 1850s did not mean nice young woman with a medical degree. It meant abortionist. It meant someone who operated on the wrong side of the law, you know, in the shadows. If you were a respectable middle-class matron in Manhattan, you didn't go to anyone who called themselves a female physician. Female physician was the listing in the directory next to someone like Madame Restel, the notorious Fifth Avenue abortionist.
So they really had to fight against both the stigma within the institution and, I guess, society as a whole, that women were not capable or were never going to be good at it, but also that if a woman was doing this, they were probably actually doing something clandestine, and they were probably, you know, what might have been considered at the time pretty immoral.
No, I mean, Elizabeth, in her memoir, which she wrote at the end of her life, talked about someone like Madame Restel, as an abortionist, being sort of a negative inspiration for her, that Elizabeth Blackwell, in becoming a physician, partly wanted to redeem the term female physician, because she didn't believe in abortion.
It is so funny that we often look at the past with our modern lenses and we think, if somebody was a trailblazer, she was probably also an advocate for, you know, women's reproductive choice. And maybe she was in her way, but obviously what we think of as feminism or what we think of as liberalism or progressivism, it varies throughout the times and it varies from person to person.
Exactly. Absolutely.
Oh, that's fascinating. So okay. I want to kind of get into their lives a little bit more. And maybe as you were doing your research, because again, most of us who have heard of Elizabeth have only heard of Elizabeth and we haven't heard of Emily. So I'm interested in some of the dynamics between the sisters. What was the age difference again?
5 years.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. And again, Elizabeth sort of anointed Emily. She said, "Emily, I claim you to follow me into medicine." And Emily kind of looked about her. She actually was very drawn to natural science. She was much more of a scientist than Elizabeth ever was. Elizabeth was more of an idealist and a moralist. She sort of thought about it and thought, you know, that sounds kind of good. I think I'll go for that. And then, you know, so throughout their sort of entwined careers, there was always this tension where Elizabeth was always drawn more toward public health and moral reform, hygiene, ideas and issues and lecturing and writing more than actual practice. Whereas Emily was a surgeon. She was very interested in innovative technique. She thought that the role of a woman doctor was to be as good a practitioner as any man. Whereas Elizabeth really thought of a woman doctor eventually as a teacher armed with science more. Part of that was sort of inherent in their personalities. Part of that stemmed from a crisis that happened to Elizabeth early in her medical career. Having just graduated from medical school, she went to Paris to get some practical experience and was working in a public hospital, not a very healthy place, where she contracted an infection that caused her to lose one eye.
Oh, gosh.
Yes. So she was fitted for a glass eye, which she wore throughout her adult life. Very few people knew that she was disabled in this way. She didn't talk about it. But when you have one eye, you can't be a particularly effective surgeon. And it directed her even more strongly toward, you know, thinking about medicine, talking and writing about medicine rather than doing medicine.
Interesting. Okay. So then we end up, okay, at this point in time, are they still running this women's clinic or this women's hospital?
So, yeah. So the women's hospital was founded in 1857. By 1869, they added the Women's Medical College. And then having established that, they actually parted ways. Elizabeth went back to England, where they had been born and lived as small children before coming to America. She'd always wanted to be back in England, and she pursued public health initiatives in England and wrote and lectured. Emily remained in New York and ran the hospital and the college that they had founded very capably. And so they spent the last 40 years of their lives in two different places, no longer yoked together. And I think with some relief, they had the arc of the story is really that they couldn't have achieved what they achieved without each other. But once they achieved it, they were, I think, happier not to be in each other's way.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So, you know, it seems like there was almost a difference too in terms of like how they saw their legacies, that they sort of had different life goals. It sounds to me like Elizabeth knew what she was doing. She knew she was a trailblazer, and that was an important part of her identity.
That's exactly right. I think, you know, she chose medicine, again, not because she was drawn to medicine, but because she wanted to make a point. She was drawn to the writing of Margaret Fuller, who was a transcendentalist thinker, writer, editor, and had published a best-selling book called Woman in the 19th Century, right when Elizabeth was coming of age. And that book was all about the fact that humanity was not going to reach a new level of enlightenment until women proved what they could do. And Elizabeth read this at a very formative moment and I think really thought of herself as someone whose life could prove that point, whose life could be a beacon for the enlightenment of humanity. She thought that way. She thought at that level. Whereas Emily, once led into the field of medicine, was just really into being a good doctor. She didn't really care about recognition to the same degree that Elizabeth Blackwell did. Elizabeth Blackwell really, she wanted to be a beacon, and you can't be a beacon if your light doesn't shine brightly. So she wanted to shine and be noticed.
Right. And of course, they kind of lived their lives in that way as well, affecting change, obviously, and, you know, and really kind of carrying that torch in the way that they best knew how, and in a way that sort of, I guess, felt the most authentic to them, and ultimately did change so many lives and did set a course for so many women in the future. Like, maybe going to, you know, an all-male medical college didn't really open those doors, but then saying, well, then screw it, we'll make our own, really did open up a lot of doors. We'll make our own institution. We'll make our own clinic.
Right. We'll make our own thing, and we'll make it at least as rigorous as what we experienced among the men. And then the interesting thing was that when in 1899 is the year that medical schools like Johns Hopkins and Cornell started admitting women. And as soon as that happened, Emily Blackwell shut the college down. She said, this college, its intention, its purpose was to hold the door open for women until men woke up. And now that's happening. We don't need to be here anymore. The infirmary stayed open for more than a century, but the college was immediately closed because it had fulfilled its purpose as far as she was concerned.
Interesting. And I'm wondering if at the same time when these larger institutions finally said, okay, women can join our ranks, although of course they were treated as second-class citizens within those institutions.
Yes, that's a different book.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, gosh. I'm wondering too, that nothing really changed in terms of the, or maybe I shouldn't say nothing, what changed in terms of the faculty, in terms of the staff, in terms of the administration? I mean, this was still run part and parcel by men.
At those medical schools? Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
And so it's unfortunate almost that closing down the institution, I totally understand the reasoning. Like, what we don't want to do is create a separate but equal or separate but unequal institutional, you know, something that was supposed to facilitate becoming a barrier. But at the same time, like, we're not there yet.
Right. But I think that is a little bit of Emily Blackwell's MO. I think she wasn't thinking about legacy necessarily. Mm-hmm. She was thinking about the job at hand. And she wasn't taking quite the global view, that the 30,000 foot view that Elizabeth would have in her place, I think.
You know, I'm interested. I forgot to ask, like, about their childhood, about their upbringings, about their parents. Was there something special about Elizabeth and Emily? I can imagine that they still were endowed with enormous privilege. And that being the trailblazers, even though they were women and even though that was a massive saddle, they were still white women who probably came from some amount of privilege?
Yes and no.
Okay, interesting.
So there were 9 Blackwell siblings. 8 of them were born in Bristol, England. And their father was a sugar refiner. Bristol was a sugar capital. And he was a bit of a paradox. He was a man who had made his fortune in the sugar industry And in his spare time, he was an ardent abolitionist.
Hmm,
so if you think about that for a second, you quickly hit up against the paradox. Sugar trade was based on Caribbean cane plantations that were fueled with enslaved labor. So this is a man who was an unorthodox person. He had grown up in the sugar trade, but he wanted to change it. So he moved his family of 8 and then 9 children all the way from Bristol via New York, and then all the way out in 1838 to Cincinnati, which was basically the edge of the known universe in that moment for white people, with the dream of finding a way to make sugar out of sugar beets with free labor, thereby sort of fixing the moral hygiene of his industry. He was a dissenter from the Church of England. He was a very progressive thinker. He hobnobbed with all of the really progressive minds of the moment: William Lloyd Garrison, the Beecher family, which were in Cincinnati. So the children grew up with a father who gave the girls the same education as the boys. Really believed in idealism. The joke was that the children had heard so much about the evils of slavery that they refused to put sugar in their tea. Of course, the family's livelihood was the sugar industry. So there's a problem there. So this was all in the background. And then when they got out to Cincinnati in 1838, with their dreamer of a father, he promptly died before they had even really finished unpacking. And he left his widow and 9 children with about $20. So yes, they had come from some privilege and certainly from some, you know, some intellectual class standing. But as you know, as 9 children ranging in age from, I think at this point, 6 to 22, they had to rescue themselves. And they sort of teetered on the edge of ruin. And the oldest children were all girls, and they snapped into action as teachers and really rescued their family.
Interesting. And I mean, I can imagine how instrumental that sort of progressive worldview and that more egalitarian worldview must have been as an abolitionist. And this isn't always the case, as we saw with the women's suffrage movement, that sometimes, you know, gender and race relations don't go hand in hand. But it sounds like within the culture of the family, this egalitarian view was one that was really taken up, that kind of like anything he can do, she can do also.
Right. And also that a husband is, however much you love him, is no guarantee of security. None of the 5 Blackwell sisters ever married. All of them, 4 out of the 5 of them at various points pursued careers. They loved their father, but he hadn't exactly provided for them.
Right. So they didn't really see marriage as that kind of economic social structure that was so dominant then and continues to be dominant now. I'm wondering, did any of them have relationships? Were any of them gay, or did they have straight partners, or were they just kind of asexual? Or do we know?
It's hard to know because, even the vocabulary that we use today to discuss all of this was not something that was available. So it's hard to know if they always were consciously aware of what they were feeling at any given moment.
True.
I would say there was definitely, at least on the part of Elizabeth, she definitely struggled with human connection. And I don't know whether that was because she was drawn toward women and didn't know what to do with that or what. Emily, from about the last 3 decades of her life, had a female partner that she lived with, another surgeon named Elizabeth Cushier. And again, there is no doubt that that relationship was warmed by love, that they were each other's most important person. But again, I don't have archival material that gives me any information about how their relationship worked, where they slept or when. And I have too much respect for these people as my subjects to guess.
Right.
So I leave a lot to the imagination, not because I'm trying to be a prude, but just because I'm trying to be respectful of women who I've never met.
Exactly.
Although yeah. I know them very intimately. You know, I like to get out of the archive and follow my subjects around as much as possible and sort of be where they have been. And at one point I was wandering around Greenwood Cemetery in Brooklyn, which is an amazing place to wander around if you never have, where the Cushier family plot is. This is the family of Emily Blackwell's partner. And Elizabeth Cushier, the partner, is buried there. And someone had planted a rainbow flag on her grave, which almost brought tears to my eyes. It was an incredibly moving thing to see that someone knew her story and was honoring it in this very quiet way. At the same time, when I imagined her and Emily Blackwell walking by and seeing this, I could only imagine that they might be really irritated, if not appalled, that some stranger had claimed their personal, intimate lives for a political cause.
At the time, of course, this was there were cultural pressures. I mean, it was against the law. It wasn't just considered amoral, it was considered pathological, and it was illegal to engage in a same-sex relationship. So even
yes and no. I mean, I think it was you got into more trouble with the law if you were a gay man.
Absolutely. Yeah, because they actually wrote specific like anti-sodomy laws for that reason.
Well, right. If you were two spinster ladies who happened to be living together, there was nothing really, no one was really going to call you out on that.
It was kind of a don't ask, don't tell mentality at the time.
I would say, right.
But people were so, it was so beyond the pale to their thinking that they were like, that wouldn't happen. They're just two old ladies living together. Like, right. it wouldn't even enter people's consciousness that these women could be in love.
Depending on who they were, sure.
Sure.
I want Emily Blackwell to have found, passion in every direction in her late life with this partner. When they wrote about each other or to each other, Emily Blackwell didn't just say, I love her. She said, you know, she is like, sometimes she described her as being like a daughter. Sometimes she described her as being like a sister. And there's no way to know if that was just because of the poverty of the vocabulary or whether that was how she really felt about her. I don't know.
Right.
I don't know.
Oh, it's so interesting.
If I were a historical novelist, I would have really gone to town on that. But I'm not. I'm constrained by the sources.
Yeah, and by the evidence that's in front of you, and really just trying to clearly delineate that evidence without editorializing it.
Right.
You know, we do know that at the time the constraints of society were such that women were second-class citizens. We do know that the misogyny and sexism, as it continues to be today, was overtly rampant in this era. And we know, or at least we can imagine, what some of these barriers to overcome may have been. But earlier in our conversation, you had referenced a bit that this is a much more nuanced story, that it's not just like superwomen overcoming the odds, owning, you know, blazing a trail, which is how the children's books probably do read. And I'm interested, you did mention that sometimes these were not women who were easy to get along with, or like, you know, they were difficult. But I'm wondering if maybe you can point to some specific examples or tell or paint a picture for us of some of those more nuanced and complicated things that you ran into.
Sure. The most obvious one is that, Emily Blackwell was less political. Elizabeth Blackwell was more so. But Elizabeth Blackwell was decidedly out of step with the emerging women's movement. She was very vocal in it wasn't like she was lecturing about this, but, you know, when in her letters to her intimates, she talked about how she thought it was ridiculous that the women's movement had made suffrage their top priority. It wasn't that she didn't believe women should vote. She just didn't believe that women voting was the most important thing to start with.
Really?
In her mind, yeah. In her mind, she thought that if you gave women a vote when they were still sort of in thrall to their men, then all you were doing was giving men more votes because their men would tell them how to vote.
Right. So she was concerned about education.
Right. She wanted, she thought it was the cart before the horse. She thought if you can help women understand how to claim their power, how to unleash what they can do, and then you give them the vote, then they'll use it as their own opinions dictate and not because their husband told them what to do.
And it's interesting because in a way she was almost underestimating her fellow women who may very well, and I'm sure that there are plenty of examples and it may even have been the majority, who would have voted the conscience of their husbands. But in a way, it's like she wasn't seeing that the things in her exist in others and many people were self-educated.
That's an excellent point. And you know, that's another part of the story that feels very modern to me is that there's a lot of misogyny in what Elizabeth Blackwell thought.
Right. And that's what happens. It imbues into all of us.
Female misogyny, I think, is something that we all wrestle with all the time. And it's something that made the story feel very modern to me. This both large and small, Elizabeth really didn't think very highly of women in general. She tended to underestimate women across the board. And then also in the micro sense, two of her brothers married two of the most famous feminists of the moment, Lucy Stone, who was a suffrage activist, and Antoinette Brown, who was the first woman in this country to be ordained as a minister. And Elizabeth really didn't see eye to eye with them. She really didn't agree with their approach. She really wasn't comfortable with radical activism. I think she was one of those very early trailblazers who really believed that if you're going to do something truly radical, you have to do it in the most conservative way possible. Otherwise, it's not going to work.
Interesting. So it was kind of much more like, let's be a realist and let's make the baby steps as opposed to being at the bleeding edge.
Exactly.
It's fascinating. You know, I'm wondering if there's anything else in terms of the story, in terms of the nuance, the gray area, the things that you might have uncovered as you were doing your research that you wanted to make sure was known. Obviously, we don't want to give everything away because the point here is for people to buy the book and to read it. But is there anything else that we didn't touch on before we move into my final segment that you wanted to make sure that we give its due?
Yeah, I mean, I guess another interesting aspect of this, you know, sort of separate from the feminist questions, is the public health questions. I think Elizabeth Blackwell came to medicine. Emily, again, more of a scientist, more of an empiricist. Elizabeth Blackwell came to medicine as a moralist, and she came to it before germ theory, right? So in her mind, you know, health and good behavior were very closely connected. And when germ theory finally became generally accepted, the idea that an amoral microbe would be responsible for something like venereal disease, syphilis, gonorrhea, how could that be? You know, and it's very interesting. Another, this is another, you know, part of the complexity is that, you know, this is a woman who was a pioneering woman doctor who didn't always accept scientific advances. She struggled a little bit with some of the things that contradicted the sort of crucible she had been formed in. Her sister Emily was much more flexible and much more interested in finding a better way in assimilating new ideas. And that tension is also a part of the story.
I mean, it's fascinating because we often forget, and I know it's such a simple thing, but we forget that these historical figures are people, and they're people that lived in a different time, but they're people just like us. There's nothing evolutionarily different about a person in the mid-1800s. They had all of the same faculties that we had, the same types of struggles that we had, the same internal mechanisms that we had. And, you know, people are complex. And it's so amazing that you were able to dig deep and shine a bright light on these two individual people who did so much for the women who followed them, but of course, we're also just people.
Right. With all their flaws.
Yeah.
And I think that's the lesson of this story is that you can honor profoundly a trailblazer like the Blackwells without always loving every single thing they did. I think, you know, this is a moment in our history where we're finally, you know, we finally have a female vice president. And part of the reason we don't have a female president and didn't for the last 4 years was that we wanted our heroines to be likable. And the fact that they weren't always likable was an insurmountable barrier. And I think that holds us back. And if we can get better at honoring and admiring people who who aren't always everything we want them to be, we'll get a lot farther.
Absolutely. It's why we see these amazing social movements. Nevertheless, she persisted. I'm a nasty woman. Like, I am going to own that label and wear it with pride. And I think that that is, it's definitely a change in the tides that we're seeing. Well, Janice, before we wrap things up, I was hoping that I could ask you to answer the same two questions that I close my show by asking all of my guests to answer. And they're pretty big picture questions. Are you ready for them? All right. So I want you to think about the future. And as a historian, this is kind of interesting. You must think about the future often in reference to the past. So I want you to think about the future in whatever context is relevant to you right now. So it could be, you know, something you're working on, something very personal for you, or it could be a bigger picture, societal, global, even cosmic. And I want you to first tell me, the first question is, what is the thing that's keeping you up the most at night? The thing you're most concerned about, worried about, maybe even a little bit pessimistic or cynical about. And then on the flip side of that, what are you truly, optimistically, authentically looking forward to? You know, what are you hopeful for?
I think it's sort of the same thing. I think that this moment that we're in is demanding that we finally learn, each of us, how to recognize the full and equal humanity of every single person we encounter, no matter how different they are, no matter how other they seem, to understand that everybody we encounter is human and wrestling with all of the things that we wrestle with, and to connect at that level. And that's, I think, sometimes I despair because we see every day examples of people failing to do that in really spectacular ways. But I'm the parent of an 18-year-old and a 21-year-old, and I am astonished at how much better they are at this than I was at their age, and that I was taught to be by my elders. So that's what gives me hope. Somebody coined the terms, and then they're what I strive to be. I strive to be a curious elder. And in order to do that, you have to have good youth spies. I'm enormously optimistic about my youth spies, and I hope they help me and help everyone who's a fogey like me, to be more open in every way to everyone around us.
Oh, I love that. Well, Janice, thank you so much for taking the time today to share with us this beautiful story of the Doctors Blackwell. I hope everybody, goes to wherever books are sold and checks out a copy for themselves. I learned an awful lot. It was a really meaningful discussion.
Well, thank you. And it was meaningful for me too. I appreciate it.
I'm glad to hear it. And everybody listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.